History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there, down the street, around the corner, maybe even right next door. And you know, I tell you that every week, but sometimes I need to be reminded of that truth as well, and this week's episode is certainly a testament to that. Our goal, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, it's incredible the perspective we can pick up. It's amazing how much we can learn. We're educated, yes, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. On today's program, you're going to hear from a humble hero who finished his time as a Navy fighter pilot just one aerial victory shy of being an ace. If any one of his unconfirmed kills had been confirmed, he would have carried that title. But Chuck Houston isn't just a decorated fighter pilot. He's an accomplished sculptor, first-class woodworker, and also the author and compiler of one of the most impressive and thorough books I've seen produced by World War II veterans, and I've read quite a few. And this is one that has really raised my eyebrows this week, because after interviewing veterans for 15 years, I certainly didn't think there would be a story like this right under my nose. A gentleman who for 15 years I lived just a few blocks away from, with not only an incredible life, but a connection to the college football program I'm privileged to announce the games for, and this remarkable book. If you've ever browsed around on hometownheroesradio.com, you know there's a library tab, links to books written by or about the veterans who've shared their stories on this program. Some of them are New York Times bestsellers on that list, but I don't think any of those books have ever floored me like this one. It's called Flying with Iron Angels, The Diaries and Memories of Navy Carrier Pilots Fighting the Pacific War in 1944. I hope you'll take a look at it, and I have to thank one of our listeners, Chris Cochran of Sacramento, California, for letting me know about the book and the remarkable man who wrote it. Chuck Houston is 96 years old now, and he'll be the first to tell you that while some memories have endured, others have gone a little fuzzy. But this book he wrote, his labor of love, will give us some touch points throughout the interview today. We'll talk about some of his closest calls, as well as the loss of so many friends, including one of his college football teammates at Fresno State. Let's start out in the early years, though. You grew up here in Fresno with a sister. How early did you get interested in aviation? Did you have some of those aviation heroes like Lindbergh or Doolittle and those guys?
Oh, yes, since way back. All those old-timers were my big heroes. From the time I was a little kid.
You were reading about them in the newspaper or what?
Oh, in a newspaper. It was a lot of exposure all the time.
Is that something you always dreamed of doing yourself, flying?
Oh, yes. That was my big ambition when I was a little kid, to get in a plane and fly.
Did you have any idea that war was imminent, that there could be a war that America got caught up in?
Oh, yes, we could all feel it coming on. It was all in the papers and on the radio. It was all building up.
So you're hearing about what Hitler is doing in Europe and what the Japanese are doing in the Pacific. And did you have any Japanese-American friends or classmates?
Oh, yes, I had quite a few. They were good friends, and of course, they were in a tough position, but they were good friends.
And do you remember anything about that day, December 7th? Do you remember hearing that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Well, only vaguely. I do remember being glued to the radio, but I don't remember any details about it.
And I've had a lot of people tell me how things changed after that. Certainly for your Japanese-American friends, it changed. They were rounded up and sent to camps and held behind barbed wire. For you, was there an immediate desire to get involved somehow, to join the service, or did you wait a little while?
Right away, we were ready to go.
Well, in your book, Flying with Iron Angels, you say, Gene Streeter and I joined the Navy together in June 1942. Five of us friends from Fresno went up to San Francisco together to sign up for flight training. Gene Streeter, Robert Clancy, Robert Garner, and Donald Gray, all of us recent students at Fresno State College. What made you believe that you could be a pilot? because a lot of guys tried, but not all that many succeeded. What was it that gave you the confidence to try?
Oh, I knew I could be a pilot. It was just automatic. I just knew without any doubt that I would be a pilot. As I remember, a few were killed along the way. It was a case of various guys getting killed at various times in different ways all the way along. There was a lot of excitement mixed in with it.
And you write about a lot of that in this book. But I'm wondering if you can think back to that young man, that teenager, signing up out of Fresno State to go be a pilot. Did the inherent danger weigh on you at all? Did you think there was a chance that you might not come back?
I suppose there may have been a little thought back there, but I didn't pay much attention to it. I was interested in flying, and I knew I would be the victorious one.
Well, and you have four confirmed aerial victories to your credit, one shy of being an ace. Some of those unconfirmed, if they got confirmed, would make you an ace. What about the decision, though, to fly for the Navy as opposed to the Army? You could have gone in the Army Air Corps. What was it about the Navy that attracted you?
Probably the fact that they weren't here. The Army was right here, so they were too familiar. The Navy was out there and was out on the ocean and was more exciting and distant and adventurous.
Well, I guess that's a point. So you grew up in Fresno, and Hammer Field was being constructed and then operated at that time. And this idea of carrier flying was brand new. Now we're all used to it, and we watch the jets take off. But this had as a kid, you never heard about this. This was something, you were a pioneer, weren't you?
That was all new stuff, yeah. New adventures.
Did you have in your mind an idea of which particular Navy aircraft you thought you would like to fly?
Fighter planes, always. That's what I wanted. The Hellcat.
What was it like to fly the Hellcat? Because there aren't too many guys around anymore who actually flew a Hellcat. What was that plane like to fly?
It was a real thrill. It had power. It could just do all kinds of exciting maneuvers. Just a wonderful airplane. It was just a great plane, and I just fell in love with it. Just loved to fly it.
I'll get into some of the specifics, and what I'd love to do is read some of your magnificent book here and have you comment on some of the things you wrote. But maybe let's cover a little bit just generally speaking here. So if you look at the totality of your missions, and I mentioned the four aerial victories, and we know if you shot four enemy planes down, you came close to being shot down plenty yourself just by the nature of aerial combat. But if you had to go through, for someone who's completely unfamiliar with this idea, the different hazards you were facing, the different things that could have ended your life if it didn't go your way, how many different factors did you have to take into consideration and watch out for?
They were endless. Things are happening from every direction all the time. You had to have your head on a swivel, watching in every direction, because you never knew what was coming in on you.
And it could come in from a ship down below, from a plane up above, from a plane right in front of you?
Any direction. We were a great target up there.
And what about the weather?
Well, of course, weather was always a great factor because we were in and out of clouds all the time and rain squalls. Weather was a very important factor, and especially when it came to being able to land back on the carrier. It was nice to be able to see the deck.
And generally speaking, how would your missions unfold? Are you flying in formation? What was the typical MO?
Typical four-plane division. Of course, then we would also group various divisions together. Could sometimes have 12, 16. But basically, we started off as two planes and then four planes in a division. We had a section of two and then four. And then we would gather divisions together, and we could have many, many dozens of us in a flight.
And in addition to your Hellcats, I guess you're working in concert with a lot of other different aircraft too, right, from your carrier? So your carrier's also going to have the F-4U Corsairs or the TBF Avengers.
Yes, we were always supporting them. And, of course, we were always above and out to the side of the bombers, protecting them from many Japanese planes.
And what about the armament aboard your Hellcat? What all did you have at your disposal?
Well, we had six big machine guns in our wings. We had our machine guns up in the cowling or at the engine. And of course, we had armor plate around us, behind us, and under us, so that planes coming in from different angles might shoot at us, but we had heavy steel plates that protected us. It seemed pretty fast, but actually not very fast. We really weren't that fast an airplane, but of course, when you're in a plane, it can seem awfully fast.
And you have to make decisions really fast. Well, I want to go through and pick some sections out of your book and read it to you and ask you about it. See what kind of memories it evokes for you. Again, this book is called Flying with Iron Angels. It is about 2 inches thick. You're going to build your biceps if you carry it around. It is an exhaustive history of his squadron and his air group flying off the USS Wasp in World War II. You spent plenty of time in training in a lot of different planes getting ready to fly the Hellcat. But was there any instruction or advice or caution or warning that you look back on and you say, that was actually really helpful to what I experienced in the air? Maybe it even saved my life?
I can't think of any one thing, but there were many, many endless things. All the information we got along the way and training, it all built up. No single piece.
Well, I do know of a story in your book. It wasn't in training, but in combat. But you talk about a valuable lesson you learned. It was September 21st, 1944, the same day your roommate, Al Lorraine, was killed in action. You write about what you thought had happened that day over Manila Bay, and then what you learned through writing the book that completed that picture. You cite after-action reports from different squadrons aboard your ship. And then you say, as all the readers hang on your every word, this is what really happened. As each of us rolled into our dives from 10,000 feet, our fighters led the way, strafing the guns firing up at us from the ships below. Behind the first fighters in the long string of diving planes, I was out to the left side of a dive bomber with my trigger finger putting out 6 lines of tracer bullets at the ship below in my gun sight. So let me pause in that narrative there and ask you, what does that feel like when you start your dive and you're going down, down, down with guns a-blazing, and the other stuff is flying back up at you? Most of us will never experience that in our lives. So can you help us understand what those few seconds feel like in the cockpit?
It's pretty hard to put it into words because there's so much emotion involved. The excitement of shooting at someone, and of course the excitement of being shot at. It's hard to put into words.
I think a lot of people would be closing their eyes and clenching every muscle in their body. How about you?
No, you're busy. All of your muscles are very busy, pushing your feet on the rudder pedals and your hands on the stick and your other left hand on the throttle. Your feet and your hands are very busy.
And how do you know when to pull up?
You see what's happening. You see the water coming up at you. You know you've got to pull up. All those things just kind of happen automatically.
Well, let's continue with your story here, as you so adeptly wrote. Suddenly, we were halfway down to the water. A stream of tracer bullets came from my right side, passing between me and the SB-2C, and then a Tony flew between us, crossing close in front of me and almost into my stream of bullets. I kept my trigger finger pressed down while pulling back on the stick to raise my fire just a little bit higher, and the Tony would pass right through my bullets, I hoped. Unfortunately, by that time, I had continued firing my guns too long without a pause, and I was going to find out soon that I had burned out all 6 gun barrels. I pulled after the Tony, and as he came out of his dive, I was behind him along with another F-6F. As we reached the edge of Manila Bay at Bataan Peninsula, I had gained on the Tony enough to shoot again, but just as I fired, he pulled into a very tight turn at the perfect time to give me a hard deflection shot. It was then that I saw my line of bullets corkscrewing and tumbling wildly, and I knew my guns were gone. So, for someone who's never been a fighter pilot, they might not understand what we're talking about here, but restraint is a pretty important skill for a fighter pilot to have, isn't it, with regard to the guns and how to manage them correctly?
Well, yes, you don't want to overdo it and ruin your guns. So you had to fire and hold back and not overdo it.
So in this case, you had overdone it, and now you're firing the guns again, and you really have no control of where the bullets are going. Am I getting that right?
That's right. The barrels are melted, curved, and curled up, and they're just tumbling out of the barrels. They're not doing any good anymore.
So You continue. The story isn't done. Right then, I should have given up the whole thing and gone back to protect our bombers. But I was so mad at this guy for busting through our formation, I wasn't thinking clearly and was just determined to get him. We straightened out again, heading north along the shoreline of Bataan Peninsula. I pulled closer and fired my guns higher above him, hoping some of my tumbling bullets would drop onto him and do some damage. But each time, just as I started shooting, he pulled another hard turn to counter me. This guy was an excellent pilot, and he repeated this maneuver about four times as we raced north along the coast, getting down closer and closer to the water. My plane was faster than his, so I kept gaining on him each time. I had hoped the other F-6F would move in and hit the Tony, but soon he was gone. Now we had dropped down to about 100 feet of altitude and were flying over the rice paddies just west of Manila City. The Tony pulled another very tight turn into me and broke loose enough to come back at me head-on. His four guns were flashing at me, while my six guns were putting out the tumbling lines of corkscrewing bullets going harmlessly toward him. Maybe they looked dangerous to him, but I knew better. Again, I'm thinking about what that felt like for you. You got a plane flying straight at you, and his guns work fine, and all his bullets are heading at your plane, and you're pretty much defenseless. That's got to be a horrible feeling.
Yes, it's a very, very unsettling feeling, but it only happens for a short instance. It doesn't go on very long.
And you wrote in your book here that this Japanese pilot in that Tony was an excellent pilot. The time that you were over there, the missions you flew, was that typical? Were you often up against pilots you could tell were experienced? Or were there times where those pilots weren't quite as sharp as you were?
They were always sharp. They were good pilots, very good pilots. They flew very good airplanes. They were a tough crowd to fight against.
And you described in this narrative that your mistake was getting so upset and offended by him busting through that you chased after him. But it sounds like in the comment you just made that you carry a lot of respect for the pilots that you were flying against.
Lots of respect. They were brave men and put up a good fight and took everything we could do to go up against them.
All right, well, that story wasn't done, so I'm going to keep reading. Again, these are all your words. We passed each other nearly head-on with about 20 feet between our two right wingtips, and as I looked across, I could see the helmeted face in his cockpit looking back at me. This is the only time during the war that I actually saw the face of the human I was fighting rather than just an airplane. That sounds like that made an impression on you.
Yes, it made an impression. It's still there. The image is still there, yeah. I don't think it changed anything. They were our targets, and we were out there to shoot them down.
Well, you continue. By this time, I knew the whole effort was hopeless. I would never shoot down this Tony with these burned-out guns, and if we repeated this routine enough times, he might very well get me. So after our head-on pass, I continued flying to the east and watched him in my rearview mirror as he flew to the west, leaving a thin trail of smoke behind him. He wanted to go home, and I decided to let him. I flew across Manila Bay, which was littered with the smoking remains of enemy ships. The late afternoon sky was empty of planes except for mine, and I flew across Luzon and then about 200 miles out into the Philippine Sea to find the Wasp. I must confess at this point that what I did that afternoon was not very smart, and also I ignored the flight tactics and doctrine that had been so thoroughly drilled into us. Fighter pilots were not supposed to go chasing off alone on personal missions. The fighter pilot's primary job and responsibility was to protect our bombers, and I had been wrong to let myself be sucked out of position and away from our group of planes. Also, it was just dumb luck that saved me from another Japanese plane picking me off while I was concentrating on that one Tony. So that's what you wrote in this book published in 2001. But my question is, did you understand that right away? Those lessons that you reflect on here and say, that was not the way to do it, did that have an impact right there in that moment that changed how you flew after that?
Yes, it had an initial impact, but it took a little while for it all sink in and for me to gradually wise up and become a little smarter pilot.
And I've got to ask you this one too. And everybody's got a little different view on it. And I respect yours, whatever yours is. So you say it was just dumb luck that saved me from another Japanese plane picking me off while I was concentrating on that one Tony. And I know that was not your only close call. We could probably sit here all day talking about the things that could have killed you in World War II. So was it all just luck that you came back here to Fresno to raise four kids, to create all these sculptures and woodworking? Or as you contemplate, as you took all the time to write this book, do you feel that someone was pulling some strings or someone was protecting you? How do you really feel about it?
Well, naturally, I felt I was the world's greatest fighter pilot. That's taken for granted. But I knew that there was an awful lot of luck, that someone was riding along with me and protecting me. I was a very lucky pilot.
And what a privilege to have this pilot with us today. Check out the photos of Chuck Houston then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also find a link to his book, Flying with Iron Angels. And there's much more to come, from miraculously surviving a crash in training to his four confirmed aerial victories and even some of the unconfirmed. Our conversation with this decorated World War II Navy fighter pilot continues right after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website, myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Chuck Houston, 96 years old, of Fresno, California. A decorated Navy fighter pilot in World War II with VF-14 flying off the aircraft carrier USS Wasp in the Pacific. Later on, he would design architectural projects, manufacture ceramics and building materials, and of course pump out piece after sterling piece of sculpture. His finest masterpiece, however, may just be the book Flying with Iron Angels, about all those courageous men flying off the Wasp. The last page of that book is the program from a memorial service aboard the Wasp in November 1944. From Chuck's fighter squadron alone are the names of 17 fighter pilots who never got to come home. Many of them lost at sea, their remains never recovered. Chuck, you were a 21-year-old kid dealing with the loss of your friends, and a couple of times it was pilots that you roomed with. You were the one who had to gather up their belongings. How did you handle all that emotional trauma?
I think mainly you just try to bottle it up, because it's happening over and over. You really don't get all emotional about it. You just have to close the door and bottle it up.
Is that something that developed over time, that became easier for you to deal with over time when it happened again and again?
It was always painful. You do get used to it, but it was always painful losing a friend.
And I always try to imagine what it would be like if I were in your shoes. First of all, I can't imagine being in those shoes. But is there a moment when something like that happens where you feel or hear yourself saying, that could have been me, or what if it's me next time? Did you allow yourself to have those thoughts, or did you just tune them completely out?
It was always there. You always knew from day to day and flight to flight it could end any time. So it was exciting, but you lived with it. It was something that was happening every day, and you never knew when the bad time was going to hit you.
And those missions, were they long periods of getting ready, being on alert, and then an intense moment of combat? Were they pretty steady throughout, where you had to be up the whole time. If you think back on a mission from takeoff to landing and the ebb and flow of that, how would you try to help us understand what that feels like from the beginning to the end?
Well, of course, there's the excitement of just the takeoff and joining up in formation. And then from then on, it's just routine formation flying until you get to the target. And then there's the excitement of the diving and gunshots coming up at you from below and any enemy planes that happen to be around. So it changed from time to time, from boredom, monotony, to excitement.
What was the most exciting part of it for you, where you'd feel the adrenaline pumping the most?
Well, of course, nothing is much more exciting than all those big guns shooting up at you. That's quite exciting. But then you do get quick bursts of excitement with an enemy plane coming in, firing at you. So it changed from quick shots of emotion to steady drum beats of fire coming up at you.
So this is one of your aerial victories. In your book, you appropriately titled it, My First Date with a Francis. The after-action report says that Ensign Houston overtook a Japanese Francis, that's a twin-engine plane. It used full power, and by the time you'd reached 20,000 feet, you were within firing range. Ensign Houston's first burst started the Francis smoking. At this point, Ensign Houston began to feel the effects of the high altitude and got his oxygen mask on with some difficulty as he was beginning to get quite groggy. He fired several more bursts at the enemy plane when his illuminated gun sight went out. He tried firing a few rounds without it, but was unable to see his tracers because of the thick clouds. By pushing the circuit breaker, he got the sight on and was forced to repeat this continuously in order to keep the sight on. After firing around 100 rounds in repeated bursts, both of the Francis's engines burst into billows of black smoke and the plane whipped into a tight spin. Ensign Houston had to switch immediately to instruments due to nil visibility and decided against following the enemy plane down as he did not know how low the base of the overcast went. It's talking about you getting a little groggy in the cockpit. Had that ever happened to you before, where you had a shortage of oxygen and you got lightheaded up there?
Oh, yes. It was a familiar feeling. We knew what it felt like. You just started to lose consciousness.
Did you ever completely black out?
I don't think so. I was frequently right on the verge of it.
Yeah, I've had a lot of pilots, especially dive bomber pilots, talk about graying out sometimes as they're pulling up, or maybe just because of altitude. But that always strikes me as really unsettling. If you're losing consciousness and you're going hundreds of miles an hour in a big hunk of metal, that seems like that could be kind of dangerous.
Well, yes, it's an unsettling experience, but you're going through unsettling experiences over and over again through the whole flight.
And I imagine a lot of the things you experienced were things you were experiencing for the first time, right? That no one could tell you what to expect or prepare you for, that you just had to be ready to adjust on the fly, as they say?
You had to be ready for anything, whatever came up.
Well, here's what came up in that circumstance, according to your book again. You saw a fast-climbing, faint gray shape of a twin-engine plane slowly appearing in the misty cloud in front of you. And I'll go ahead and read it in your voice. I fired. My six streams of tracer bullets were surprisingly bright inside the darkness of the cloud. I fired again, and then I noticed something strange about what I was seeing. My vision was narrowing into two small circles. I looked at the thumb of my right hand holding the control stick. The thumbnail had turned blue. Most of us cut off the tip of our glove over the right thumbnail. Why'd you cut off the tip of your glove over your right thumbnail?
So we could see the condition of our blood. We could see the color changing in our thumbnail.
So these days, if you were to have to go to the hospital for any reason, one of the first things they'd do would be to slip a little thing on your thumb to measure your oxygen content. You guys were ahead of the game a few years, huh? Just cut off the tip?
That's right. We could see the color changing.
That was the World War II version of the pulse ox meter with your thumb. So, naturally, that thumbnail had turned blue. You say, I realized that I was slipping into anoxia, lack of oxygen to the brain, and suddenly I remembered I had forgotten to put on my oxygen mask as we scrambled up to high altitude. By then, we were above 20,000 feet, much too high to fly for very long without an oxygen mask. My oxygen mask was snapped to the left side of my helmet, where I usually left it hanging next to my face while flying at lower altitudes. I grabbed it, pulled it over my face, and took some fast gulps of oxygen. My vision came right back to normal. Then I went back to firing at the plane. Problem solved. But as we know from the after-action report, immediately another problem popped up. The electric gun sight image that reflected up on the glass in front of me, the bullseye, burned out. I reached far forward and down to press the circuit breaker, and the light came back on. The gun sight went out, and I had to press the circuit breaker again. So I'm just picturing you, and I think the after-action report said 100 rounds you had to fire in a similar fashion. I'm guessing you didn't typically move around that much in the cockpit, but here you're leaning down, you're leaning back up. That sounds ridiculous. Did it feel a little ridiculous?
Yeah, it is ridiculous, all right, yeah. But you had a lot of things to do in that cockpit, moving around and moving your hands and your feet.
But every time we think the story's over, and I love your writing style here, it's not quite over yet. So here you say, our landing signal officer had been landing me for the previous 8 or 9 months, and I had rarely received a wave off from him, so I was sure he had enough confidence in me by then to let me come in a little bit high. But surprise, he gave me a wave off, and I had to pour on the gas to go around for another approach, and I had no gas to spare. By this time, with all the gun sight problems, my anoxia problem, and the fatigue from the 5-hour combat air patrol, I was running out of steam and was in a rotten mood, and I was thinking about some wild thoughts about those dirty buggers down on the Wasp. They would just be sorry when I ran out of gas and crashed into the fantail. But in spite of my abnormal mental state, I came around in a deliberately normal landing approach, got a normal cut, landed and taxied forward and parked. I sat there, totally exhausted, finally climbed out and walked slowly across the deck toward the catwalk. Suddenly, the bullhorn up on the island structure blared out, "Lieutenant Houston, walking across the flight deck, has just shot down a Jap plane attacking our fleet." The hundreds of crewmen all around the flight deck and all the officers and men looking down from the island broke into loud cheering and clapping. All at once, I was no longer so exhausted. A little public acclaim is so intoxicating.
Oh, yes, right. Everything changed then. Everything was on the upbeat.
Over the loudspeaker, they say your name, say that you just shot down an enemy plane, and who knows, maybe saved the lives of some guys aboard that plane could have hurt. What does that feel like inside when you hear that announcement and all those guys are cheering for you?
You know what a hero you are. Pretty exciting.
You're writing of another one here. A big day for the Iron Angels. October 15th, 1944. The Japanese tried a daylight raid with 60 to 80 planes, maybe even more than 100, and VF-14 shot down 30 and a half of them. I'm just going to read some of this and see what it stirs up for you. This was the big day that the Iron Angels had long been wanting. The best way I can describe the feeling in our ready room is to say that we were knee-deep in adrenaline and testosterone. What we had was the ultimate macho game. More than anything else, it was like a football team suiting up in the locker room. The same jock-type banter back and forth, subduing any uncertainties with lots of jokes. A pilot's ready room in a combat area is more like a football team's locker room than anything else I've experienced, only more so. Most males in America have shared that locker room pregame experience, so they know the feeling. Now just multiply this by 10 or more. In the first turn, I looked straight up through my canopy and saw a zero coming across the circle, making a full deflection, 90-degree run on me. Just before his guns flashed, I whipped the stick to the right and rotated up as the zero fired, and I felt the thump of his cannon shell hitting the tail of my plane and exploding. That doesn't sound like a good feeling.
No, that's a bad feeling when you feel the explosion hit your plane.
How do you assess the damage in a situation like that?
Well, you don't assess it because you can't see anything back there. You just keep flying.
Keep your fingers crossed and hope the plane doesn't do anything funny?
Well, you don't cross your fingers. They're on the stick.
So you continue. We were then in a swirling ball of airplanes in a great circle, each of us shooting at a Zeke, which was shooting at a Hellcat, which was after another Zeke. I got 1-0 and then came in behind another who zoomed almost straight up as I fired. He just kept going up, but didn't burn or fall apart as I fired, and I finally lost flying speed and dropped off. I was sure the pilot must have been dead in the cockpit, but I never claimed him as a probable. So that right there could have been your ace status.
Sure. Could have been.
But that wasn't your priority in the moment.
No, priority is just keep the fight going and try to survive.
And you're right. The whole fight was over in about 2 minutes. It was fast and wild, and it soon looked like we had run out of enemy planes. Then I saw one flying away from the action, and I went after him with Larry Dewing flying slightly behind me. This Zero pilot made the mistake of not putting his nose down and heading straight away from me. Instead, he made a hard right, nose-down turn across my flight path. I had a difficult, full deflection shot at him, far out in front of me, so I set my gun sight bullseye way, way out in front of him, and gave him a long burst. He kept going down and finally hit the water. So that's, if I'm reading this correctly, because you had said you'd gotten another earlier, then you had one you didn't claim as a probable, but it sounds like in those short 2 minutes, you shot down 3 enemy planes?
Yeah, that's right. It all happened fast.
And they didn't shoot you down?
Fortunately, they didn't do it.
But they came close enough. You say, when I taxied forward, I felt something unusual with my tail wheel. The tail was just dragging along the deck. I already knew that the Zero's hit on my plane had damaged my arresting hook because I had to manually lower it. When I got out of my plane and inspected it a few minutes later, I realized how lucky I was to have gotten back to the Wasp. That Zero's 20mm shell had gone into the left side of my fuselage just ahead of the tail surfaces. Where it went in on the left side was a clean 2-inch hole, but after it exploded inside, it came out the right side and made a jagged hole 2 feet in diameter. Even worse, the wire cables to the rudder and elevator controls were cut and just barely holding together. It was impossible to repair such major damage, so my plane was pushed over the side of the ship. But it had brought me safely back home. This sounds like some made-up story. This is not the way it's supposed to work. So that 20mm shell almost killed you, almost took you out.
Almost. That was closer than you want it to be. Yeah.
And when I asked you, how do you assess the damage, you said, you can't. Maybe that was a good thing? Maybe it was helpful not to know what kind of shape your plane was in?
Oh, yeah. You might as well not know until you get safely back to the carrier.
And I don't want to misinterpret either, because I didn't fly Hellcats. I don't know how it all works. But I'm just kind of inferring from all that if that shell had been an inch or two in one direction or another, it might have ended differently?
Oh, yes. It could have ended very differently. I would have been down in the water.
And you write there that the wire cables to the rudder and elevator controls were cut and just barely holding together. So if they'd been severed completely, you wouldn't have been able to control the plane back in?
No control, and I'd have just gone in the water.
You wouldn't have had time to do anything but that.
Well, maybe time to jump out of the plane and pull the ripcord, maybe.
And what does it feel like to see your plane, the one that you've been flying, that you just shot down 3 Japanese planes in that day, to see that plane get shoved over the side of the ship because it's not useful anymore?
It's sad to see your plane shoved over, but of course at that time the plane, it's useless. It's all shot up, so you might as well get rid of it. Makes you feel very lucky to have made it, very lucky. In the heat of combat, you're just thinking about what you're doing right then, not thinking about tomorrow or anything else along the side. There was an aspiring to stay alive and to get to the next battle, but no great desire to be an ace or anything like that. I was one of the youngest pilots in the Navy. Nearly all the other guys in my squadron were several years older than I was. There was one other pilot in the squadron, Skip Corey, and he was the youngest pilot in the Navy, and he was a few days younger than I was.
And there's a story in your book where you and another pilot, Joe Doherty, because you're both younger and single, conspire to take the 2 planes available that day and keep your friend Don Gruber from flying because he was married and had a newborn. It describes how the 2 of you even rigged a coin flip to ensure Gruber wouldn't fly that day. That happened July 4th, 1944, and on the 75th anniversary here a couple months ago, you received a note from Gruber's family thanking you. Because the reality is, he would have been killed. He would have been flying the plane Doherty flew and been in the same spot. Doherty, of course, did not come back from that mission. You did, and you said earlier that this happened enough that you almost got used to it and you managed those emotions. But I see the emotion and gratitude from the Gruber family that you and Joe were willing, really, to trade your lives for his. So I read about Doherty's death or your roommate Al Lorraine who didn't come back from another one of your missions. And what I wonder is, over all this time, and it took hours and hours and really years of your life to put this book together, did you ever find yourself imagining about Al, Joe, whomever, here's the kind of life he would have led if he had made it home safely?
Oh, yes, there's always that thought. Wonderful young men, their lives were cut short while they were still young men. I look back with great fondness on those good friends.
And there is another story along those lines that we're going to talk about when we come back. A lifelong friend and former college football teammate who would be awarded the Navy Cross for a heroic decision that would cost him his life. We'll hear about it from 96-year-old Chuck Houston when we come back. I know I've said it a time or two, and you're hearing it for yourself when I read some of these passages, but this book is amazing, Flying with Iron Angels. And that name, Iron Angels, there's a story there. There's an insignia there, and it has Chuck Houston's name all over it. We'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 96-year-old Chuck Houston of Fresno, California, prolific F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, and author of the book Flying with Iron Angels. There are so many hidden historical treasures in this book. A famous First Lady makes an appearance. There are some other names you'll recognize. But most of all, a real picture of what aerial combat in the Pacific was like for those pioneering carrier pilots like Chuck in World War II. And that title, The Iron Angels, remember, this was a brand new squadron aboard a brand new carrier. Chuck is a plank owner on the Wasp, CV-18. And there's another historic claim he has that ties back into his artistic skills. I mentioned his sculpting prowess, but he isn't bad with a sketch pad either. And if you read far enough in his book, you'll see for yourself. They were trying to find a name and an insignia for your squadron. And people were throwing names around, and they talked about the Red Rippers. And you write that, one night, I awoke out of a sound sleep in BOQ with a mental image of a little knight in armor with angel wings and a halo, standing on a cloud and holding a big machine gun on his shoulder. I jumped out of bed and made a pencil drawing of this idea, and under it I printed the Iron Angel. And of course, that image is in your book and on the squadron insignia. Is that really how it happened? Just in a dream, or just woke up in the middle of the night, or what?
That's it. Just woke up and there it was in my mind.
Is that something that's happened to you frequently over the years with a piece of art or a concept that it comes to you that way?
Oh, yes, very often. Lots of those ideas shape up while I'm sleeping or halfway, and lots of different ways the ideas come to life.
Well, and a lot of people have ideas, but sometimes they're hesitant to share them with others. So you get this idea, and you draw it up, and you write the Iron Angel. But then you have to see if anybody thought it was a good idea. What was the reaction when you started to share that idea with folks?
Well, it was a mixed reaction. Some thought it was great, and some were just lukewarm, as usual with people. But enough of them liked it along with me that it kept growing and growing, and pretty soon it was a reality.
I've interviewed so many veterans, a lot of them will show me their squadron insignia, or, you know, whether it's a different branch of service, their unit insignia. A fair amount of the Army Air Corps squadron insignias had something to do with a well-known cartoon character, and there were even some that were drawn by Walt Disney himself. So I guess you were in pretty good company with your little illustration there, huh?
Yeah, I'd say that's very good company. That became our official squadron insignia on all of our flight suits. That was our official insignia. I was very proud of that insignia and everything that it stood for. It was the trademark of our outfit. You were angels by act of Congress, but it would take an act of God to make you act like angels. Yeah, that was a comment that was made.
Well, let's get into some of those times where it seemed as though you had an angel on your shoulder, including one even before you got aboard the Wasp. So you write here, you say, "For those who haven't had such an experience, I'll describe some of the feelings a pilot has when going through a major crash in an airplane. October 19th, 1943 was the day my good luck almost left me. I was returning from a gunnery flight and ran out of gasoline while flying in the traffic circle around the field. My engine sputtered once or twice and then just quit. I was only a few hundred feet above the treetops, so I had about 10 seconds to drop the seat as low as it would go, cinch up my seat belt and shoulder straps as tightly as I could get them while I was gliding silently down toward the trees. As I started hitting the treetops, it became a very rough, very noisy ride that seemed to go on forever. When everything finally got quiet, my eyes were closed, and I remember at first thinking I dreaded opening them because I knew I would see my body cut to pieces. But finally, I did open the eyelids, inspected my hands, arms, legs, no blood, all seemed to be in good condition with no parts missing. So I unbuckled, stood up in the cockpit, and looked around. Only a small part of my plane was sitting on the forest floor. All that remained was the engine and the cockpit directly behind it. The fuselage was cut cleanly off about 6 inches behind the bucket seat I'd been riding. The back half of my plane was several hundred feet back in the forest, wrapped around a large tree which had refused to be cut down as we had hit it going sideways. The two wings were cut off completely, leaving stumps of the wing roots on each side. I could see the two wings hanging from trees far behind me. We had gone between two large trees that just sheared off both wings." Okay, I'm reading that, and I'm picturing that, and that sounds just about impossible that anybody could survive that. How do you feel about it?
Well, actually, it really was nearly impossible. With a crash like that, usually you're just all crumpled up and ripped up. But I made it through all those trees.
So, of course, my mind goes to those split seconds, those moments. You've got no power. You can't go anywhere else. You're just trying to find some safe place to land. And you see all these trees, and you write in there, you close your eyes. It sounds like you thought that was it for you.
Oh, yes. It didn't look like there was much chance. It looked like that was the end.
And where does your mind go in a moment like that?
I'm not sure it goes anywhere. Maybe it sort of goes blank.
What did that feel like when you realized, hey, I didn't lose any limbs, I'm still all here, and I'm actually conscious, and I'm all right?
Quite a good feeling to know that you have all the parts of your body in one piece.
And so I'm reading your description, and I'm shocked that you survived. But it sounds like all your friends were pretty shocked you survived, too.
They were all surprised when I walked into the building because they all were sure that I was dead. They called me something when I came walking in, the ghost or something.
It says all of them in the wardroom agreed that my new nickname would be the Spirit. When I walked into the room, they had thought it must be my ghost.
That did fit. That was appropriate at the time. They thought I was a goner.
I guess I should ask you. I know that wasn't your only close call. But when you survive something that appears unsurvivable, how do you process that? Do you try to figure out why or how or who? Or do you just move on and not think about it?
You mostly move on, but it does make an impression on you. You realize how precarious our lives are. It can be gone in an instant, any day, especially the life that we were living.
So the Marianas turkey shoot is a legendary situation in World War II in June of 1944, the Battle of the Philippine Sea. As you have accounts of a lot of the different pilots in your squadron, you also have the tale of your first aerial victory. Joe Doherty, my section leader, spotted a Zeke being chased by several F-6s, and Joe cut in and fired. The Zeke flamed in the cockpit, did a wing over, crashed into the ocean, and exploded. By now, we were all getting separated, and I saw a Zero several thousand feet below, close to the water, with a few Hellcats chasing him, but unable to shoot him down. The Japanese pilot was really giving them a flying lesson, doing a series of continuous rolls, getting down close to the water, where our Hellcats couldn't match the maneuverability of the Zeke. Rather than join in this procession, I dropped down from the left side above the Zero in a steep, high side run from 8 o'clock. I began firing just as he rolled belly up, and my stream of bullets cut through the middle of the plane, through the cockpit and pilot, then set fire to his wing root. I pulled through, feeling like I almost touched him as I passed closely over him. Then, looking down and back, I saw a huge splash of water where he went in. Can you picture that as I read what you wrote about it?
Oh, yeah. I still have the picture in my mind from when I saw it years ago. The adrenaline is flowing continuously during those moments.
How close do you think you were? Were you in danger of crashing into him?
Oh, yeah. Within a few feet, yeah. Very close. It's hard to put into words. It's just, it had a long period to build up. A year or so of preparation, looking forward to it, and here it was. Here was the victory. I'm not sure that there's a word that will cover it.
This Marianas turkey shoot got its nickname because the situation in the skies that day was pretty unique. What do you remember about that big picture that day and everything that was going on around you?
Well, I remember the sky full of planes. Their planes and our planes. It was just a big swarm of activity, and you had to look in every direction at once as you chased down one that you wanted to shoot down.
And I'm guessing you'd never seen anything like that before?
No, the sort of thing that hardly anyone ever sees. We were ready for anything, every minute.
Well, you write in here about seeing smoking and burning planes everywhere and parachutes everywhere. By the end of that evening, you find out that the Iron Angels, just your fighter squadron, had shot down 11 and a half planes, and those were the first victories that your squadron had produced. And then you heard that that day more than 400 Japanese planes were shot down. I'm just imagining if you guys have never shot down any planes before, and then you have one day where you shoot down that many and they're dropping like flies everywhere, was that kind of hard to fathom or take in?
Well, it's an exciting thing. You've been looking forward and working toward it. Now it's all happening at once. It's exciting.
It seems like from reading your accounts that you and those other pilots in your squadron became pretty close.
Oh, yes. About as close as you can get. We were up against life and death every day. They were good buddies.
You write a lot about your roommate, Gene Streeter. How long had you known Gene Streeter?
Oh, for years. We went to school, Fresno State, together and played football together, joined the Navy together, went through training together and through the squadron. He was a friend from way back. Just a great guy. Just full of laughs and smart, capable guy, a very good friend.
What kind of pilot was he?
An excellent pilot. All of our pilots were excellent.
So I'm just going to go ahead and read this whole thing. It's from October 26, 1944, and you label it Gene Streeter's bad dream. Streeter wasn't scheduled to fly until later that day, so I was surprised when I woke up about 0400 and saw him already up and sitting at our desk. I knew he should have been sound asleep like our other roommate, Jiggs Lears. When I asked Gene why he was up so early, he told me about his terrible dream. In it, his plane had been diving out of control and he couldn't pull out. The dream seemed so real that he had jumped down from the upper bunk, run down the passageway, all while still asleep, and finally woke up in the head being observed by two sailors standing water guard. Gene told me that after he returned to our room, he was so upset by this dream that he couldn't get back to sleep. He was still sitting there, wide awake, when I got up from my flight. So in your writing here, you're kind of foreshadowing what's happening here. Because you and Gruber make it back from this hairy mission, and you get back on the Wasp, and some of your pilots were playing poker in the front of the room, and Gene Streeter was sitting on the arm of a chair watching the card action. You write, I called out to him, "Hey Gene, it's really rough out there." I expected him to come back with one of his usual funny remarks, but all he did was nod very seriously without smiling. This was so unusually solemn for him. That was the last time I ever saw Gene Streeter. Your book is over 400 pages long. It's a very thick, heavy, thorough book. And I don't know if there's anywhere else in this book that I saw you quote a verse from the Bible. But as you get into Eugene Streeter's Last Flight, the first thing printed there is John 15:13. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Is that what Gene Streeter did?
Yes, he went in there to help his friends and was killed.
So again, this book is not just your memories, but so many others. And this was written by Bill Finnegan Miller, Torpedo Squadron VT-14. He was an aviation radio man. And he wrote, "We were to hit the Japanese fleet in the Sibuan Sea. As we circled over them, we waited for Lieutenant Cole to dive, but something was amiss. He circled again for some unknown reason. Maybe he was already hit by anti-aircraft. So Lieutenant Morrison made our dive on a ship. Ack-ack was everywhere. We dropped our bombs. As we pulled out, I saw Lieutenant Cole's aircraft plunge into the sea just behind the enemy ship. I saw the ship firing shell after shell at Lieutenant Cole's plane, and I screamed, 'Let's go back and strafe those bastards. They're shooting at them in the water.' They were all probably dead from the crash, but aboard that plane was my closest buddy, William T. Billy. We were to meet in Al Depp's hamburger stand on Staten Island when we were relieved. He was from Bayonne across the river from my home on Staten Island. We had planned this meeting for months. Suddenly, beneath us, and heading straight for us, were three Jap fighters. The other planes were out of ammo, except for my turret gunner, E.J. Such, and me. We had no fighter coverage, and it looked like we were hung out to dry. We were mincemeat for those Zeros. I guess we all blessed ourselves. Then, from nowhere, as if by a miracle, this VF-14 F-6F Hellcat came tearing between us and the Zeros. He set himself in between them, pulling them away from us. He battled the lead plane and was ganged up on by the others. He got one Zero, but the others shot him down. I feel he knew he had to save us and sacrificed his own life so that we would get home. Thanks to the bravery of that fighter pilot, at least I would get to Al Depp's on Staten Island for that hamburger. I soon found out that pilot was Lieutenant J.G. Eugene Jarvis Streeter, VF-14, from Fresno, California. In that 1 second, he was more than enough fighter coverage. His courage will always be remembered by the combat air crewmen who watched in awe as Eugene Jarvis Streeter gave his life for me and the others in those torpedo planes. You see, our lucky streak continues as we return to the Wasp. I wish our luck could have returned Lieutenant Cole and Lieutenant Eugene Jarvis Streeter with us to the USS Wasp." I was getting a little emotional reading that. I mean, I wish I had Gene Streeter here to ask him. If there's anyone qualified to speak for him, it's got to be you. You grew up with him, went to school with him, trained with him, and you performed the same job he did as an F-6F pilot. So what kind of guts or courage or selflessness did it take for him to do what he did?
Well, the ultimate in courage and determination, you can't do any more than that.
Gene Streeter was credited with 4 aerial victories in World War II, and he had actually been given the Silver Star 8 days prior. But his actions that day, his final day, were recognized with the Navy Cross. The only decoration higher than that is the Medal of Honor. And his Navy Cross citation reads, "Lieutenant Junior Grade Streeter suddenly found himself as the only protection for 8 torpedo bombers which were making a strike against large units of the Japanese fleet. When 3 hostile fighters came in from above, he pressed home an accurate, daring attack, which destroyed one of the planes, and courageously employed evasive maneuvers with the remaining fighters, vainly attempting to lose them. Although his plane was so severely damaged that he was forced to effect a water landing, he succeeded in diverting the enemy aircraft from the torpedo bombers until assistance arrived, thereby enabling our planes to carry out their highly important mission. The conduct of Lieutenant Junior Grade Streeter throughout this action reflects great credit upon himself and was in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service." And the final line of that Navy Cross citation really says it all. He gallantly gave his life for his country. Such a powerful story. And Chuck, your old college football teammate really did live up to that passage you quoted from John 15:13. But at the time, you didn't know that for sure. One report that day suggested he may have been able to get out of his plane and make it to land. You write about how you pilots expected him to come walking back in someday. How you even experienced a recurring dream of exactly that happening, and it felt real. And his mother, Florence, maintained a shrine to him in her home, hoping someday her son would return. Because you were his roommate, you had to gather up his things, and you actually had the chance to visit his mother back here in Fresno.
I think that was harder than anything else. Just shooting down planes in combat is easier in comparison. I had a very high opinion of Streeter. There was always the sadness of knowing that his life was ended and he never had a chance to go on and do the things that I did later.
What an honor to share a little bit of Chuck Houston's story with you today. Visit hometownheroesradio.com for photos, a short video, the link to his book, and even a bonus-length podcast of this episode. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
Well, if Chuck's book is 2 inches thick, you can imagine there was some material that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time, but here on the podcast version, it's a bonus for you. What else were you up to as a kid? Because, you know, here in 2019, a lot of kids are just staring at their electronics all day. You didn't have those in the 1920s and 30s. What was that childhood like during what we've heard about as the Great Depression, but most of us didn't experience it? Do you have some memories from those years?
Well, probably nothing unusual. The usual little kid stuff, running around, kicking the can down the street and doing a lot of woodworking. I got into woodworking very early because my grandpa was with a lumber yard, and I was exposed to lots of lumber and lots of tools. From as far back as I remember, I had a knife of some kind, whittling or carting or sawing on wood, or always working on the wood.
Well, and that's evident here. I mean, literally, I can't look anywhere without seeing something that's wood or metal that you have crafted. And this is probably a tough question to answer. Out of everything that you've made out of wood or clay or metal over the years, is there a piece that you're most proud of, or you thought that was your greatest accomplishment?
That's a tough thing to answer. There are so many things, but they're emotional things. It's the person behind the object that affects me, the memory of them.
And I'm sure there are people listening that if they saw some of your pieces, and if it's okay with you, I may take a picture of a few of them to show people, that if they saw some of your work, they'd say, well, what does it take to produce work that good? So what does it take? What are the skills or the disciplines or the abilities you think someone needs? What's required to produce that kind of work?
I guess the ability to just do a lot of hard work, hard physical work, and working with tools. I love to work with woodworking tools.
I'm just thinking, because arguably one of your greatest pieces isn't wood or clay, it's ink and pages with this exhaustive history of your air group in World War II flying with Iron Angels, which we're going to talk about. But are there some parallels between Navy fighter pilot and woodworker slash sculptor in that the margin for error is probably pretty slim in both, right?
Well, yes, it's got to be right. There's one right way, and that's the right way. If you get too far off, well, you're finished.
I guess when you're making a sculpture, you can scrap that piece of wood or that clay and start with a new batch, but in the air, you don't have that luxury.
No, you usually have one chance. You screw it up once, that's usually the end.
How often did that happen to you?
Well, fortunately, it never did happen, but it was awfully close many times.
Oh, in the air it was close. I meant with wood or clay, how often did that happen where you just had to trash it?
Every time. You're always on the edge of screwing up something. Woodworking and sculpture in general was my great obsession.
In high school, Roosevelt High School here in Fresno, you were a pretty good athlete. Do I have that right?
I guess you'd say pretty good. I was never big enough to really be on the big varsity team, but we had a great junior varsity team. In fact, we were county champions. We beat them all.
Even Fresno High, the big rival?
Oh, yeah. We beat the whole works. We were undefeated.
So then you go to Fresno State, where Jimmy Bradshaw was the football coach there before World War II. And I spent a lot of time around Fresno State now. What was Fresno State like before World War II?
Well, it was a wonderful little school. It was small then. Of course, it's a big university now. It was small and full of energy and excitement.
Well, I know we're going to talk about the close calls and the exploits with Air Group 14, but it sounds like this is one that gave you a little chuckle here, as you write about in your book. One time you tried to arrange a dramatic photo of you and your Hellcat. I'll just read it in your voice. You say, "It turned out to be a funny story, but it could have turned tragic. I had arranged with a dive bomber friend to have his rear seat crewman snap a picture of me and my Hellcat flying on a return from a mission. So as we flew back from our strike near Cebu, I signaled to Standring that I was dropping out of formation. Then I cut way back on my throttle to lose speed and descend down to the bombers flying below us. But I kept picking up more and more speed as I dropped lower, and I couldn't zigzag or swing wide because that would attract the critical eye of the flight leader, who hadn't been included in my scheme. To try to remain inconspicuous but still help a little more in losing excess speed, I popped open the cowl flaps around the engine, even though my speed was a little excessive to be doing that. This worked. I cut enough speed to drop down next to my bomber friend, and I pulled in on his wing, opened my canopy, and posed there with the Central Islands in the background while the SB-2C crewman snapped pictures. Finally, I was going to have my action photo. Here was the deadly fighter pilot in his F-6F with the enemy going up in smoke in the background. What a photo it would be. Then I climbed back up, rejoined my division, and we continued on for a landing on the Wasp. But this landing turned out to be a major problem for me. When I tried to lower my wheels and landing flaps, they only partially lowered. My hydraulic pressure gauge indicated close to zero, so apparently I had popped a hydraulic line when I opened my cowl flaps at high speed. So now I was faced with probably making a water landing and losing a Hellcat, all because of my vanity photo. Did that bring back some memories there?
Yeah, it's a very distinct memory of worrisome times. Another problem. I think I did get my wheels down. I think I popped them down with my emergency pressure cylinder. Those were things we always kept in the back of our minds for emergencies.
Well, that's what it says here. You said you spent the next 10 minutes doing violent maneuvers, shaking the plane and slamming it around, hoping to get the wheels to drop down. Through all of this, Don Gruber was flying out near my wing, watching my wheels and repeatedly giving me thumbs down after each maneuver. Finally, I tried one last trick. In our plane's cockpit was installed a compressed air bottle, which fed air pressure into the hydraulic lines just for such emergencies. I slowed the plane way down, then popped the air bottle, and suddenly I felt the wheels snap into place. I looked out at Gruber, and he was giving me a big grin and a thumbs up. The air bottle pressure had finished lowering and locking the wheels, and had also finished lowering the flaps. What a relief. I was then able to make a normal landing rather than lose a perfectly good Hellcat while trying for my fighter pilot photo. And I'm just picturing you up there in this plane. And, you know, lest we forget, you're still a very young man. You're all of 20 years old up there flying this Hellcat. How big of a relief was it when the gear finally came down and you knew you can land?
The greatest of relief, yeah.
And I can't leave out the best part of the story, because the way you wrote it in this book is such an intriguing narrative, and it sucks us right in. The next paragraph after you landed, it says, "I found my bomber friend to ask how my photo turned out. He apologized and said, 'Chuck, I don't know what was wrong with our camera, but none of our photos turned out.'" So you almost got yourself killed over a photo that didn't even exist.
Right. Pretty disappointing, isn't it?